Look at us both recording already.
I know. Like,
who would have known all those years ago that we'd both be recording already?
I know that we would both own microphones.
Oh, it's so crazy to own microphones. What a world.
I know. Although you have a fancy booth. I just have it like a setup on my kitchen table. But
it should be noted. It should be noted that fancy, I mean, it's...
I know.
Yeah.
But it is a booth. But it is, and especially in these crazy times, you are able to... Oh, by the way, I'm talking to Will Arnett. You are able to... Will Arnett, the star of the HBO documentary series, The Vow.
Yeah.
You're in that, right?
I'm also in the new Pope. I'm in the new Pope.
The newest Pope.
Yeah.
Yeah. Coming at you. Poping at you.
I would make a great pope, by the way. I'm not Catholic, but I would make a great pope.
In what sense?
In the sense that I would just be like, okay, let's cut the bullshit, because I know how people look at the Catholic Church. I'd be able to say, and this is controversial, I get it, but I'd say, guys, come on. Let's cut the BS. We messed up a bunch. We've done a lot of shit. And now it's our turn to turn it around. If we want to save this thing, it's pretty clear what we got to do. We, you know, and then you just go down the list. We got to endorse gay marriage. We have to, we can't oppose it. Like just all the stuff that just like make all the logical shit.
Right. Like, in, you know, there isn't some guy in the sky that cares what you do. Like,
no.
That kind of thing.
Well, that would be number one. And yeah. I get that I would get a lot of pushback on that.
Yeah. It's kind of their thing.
I know. it'd be like going into like a car company, like going to Ford and saying, hey, you can't make cars anymore, but
but I'm going to turn this thing around.
Yeah.
We are going to make fudge from now on. We're going to get rich on fudge. Now you're out in the Hamptons, right? You're in New York. Long Island.
I was on Long Island. No, I'm back.
Oh, you are back. You're in LA again.
I'm back in on the West Coast, as we call it, Andy. And it should be noted, because we were in Long Island for a while, I just got your baby present yesterday.
Oh, really?
Last night, because it had gone out there
and
it got there. It got there when we left. And then had to be sent back here. And so I just quite literally got my hands on it last night.
Oh, good. Well, I'm glad you got it.
Thank you very kindly. It's a beautiful silk blanket.
Yeah, it's a little silky. It's my kids were turned on to them at a young age. They're just like little satin blankets that babies love to like just hold on to like a supervillain, like rubbing it between their fingers. And my daughter's 15. She still sleeps with hers.
Well, but your daughter's a supervillain, though.
Well, she is. Yeah. I mean, yeah. I mean, she's, you know, it's her island lair that she's sleeping in. But right. Yeah, on her big stash of nerve gas, it's weird that she wants to sleep at it. It doesn't seem comfortable to me. But she's like, no, I derive great pleasure from sleeping on the nerve gas step piles. Well, that's good to have you back. How's the COVID world been for you? Especially with the new baby. That's got to be weird.
It's been awesome, Andy. What a time to be alive. I, you know, and the idea of welcoming a new child into this world
now,
it's just felt so, it's just really buoyed me up.
Right. Well, it is, a lot of times when you have a baby, you feel like obliged to really care about what happens to him. But with this one, you don't have to. You know, this whole fucking place is going up in flames in no time. So it's like, this kid, you know, he'll be more like a friend than a son.
Yeah, that's right. he's more like a fellow soldier.
Yeah. Yep, exactly.
He was
like
born,
a helpless foxhole mate.
Yeah. Yeah. Who's just got to pull his weight, you know, and hope not to get trench foot. It's been great. You know, I mean, look, it's been such a weird time, and Denny's been such a blessing, and he's doing great. He came a little early, and
classic Arnett.
I know. So, don't tell everybody.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Everybody doesn't know that that's my hallmark. And he was born May 27th, and it was, you know, right in the thick of you know, the sort of the COVID lockdown out here in California and the you know, the riots and the protests. And it was just such a crazy time. And there was quite literally like smoke coming into the hospital, and he was so little and we were nervous and we had this, it was just such a weird,
yeah,
bizarro time. And, but of course it was just, it just was the time that it was, and nothing we can do about it. And we just sort of, you know, we're very lucky. So, and he's healthy and he sort of made it out. He was in the NICU for a minute and now he's out. And, so it's good. You know, it's
Great.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Thanks. Yeah.
I can now, before you had another, because you have two boys who are like in their teens now, right?
Well, 10 and almost 12. Yeah.
10. Yeah. Was it daunting, the prospect of going back to Babyville?
Yeah, I think that I glossed over it. I just was like, yeah, it's no problem. Yeah, I did it. I know what I'm doing. And then it hit, and I was like, oh my God.
Yeah, yeah.
Who told me this was a good idea?
Oh, that's right. My life is not my own.
Yeah.
Oh, it's like, fuck.
What's that noise? Oh, that's a crying. Whose crying baby is that? Oh, that's ours. You know.
Oh boy. Yeah.
Obviously, and you've heard this so many times, people talk about it, it's like we're programmed as human beings to forget that.
Yes. Yes.
How hard it is, especially those first 3 months. So I had forgotten. And I mean, now that's all it's actually been great and it's been okay, but it's just whatever. It just takes its toll and it's hard and it's hard on your partner. And it's been, but it's been good though. You know, we've made it through, and I kind of feel like we're just sort of like coming out of that first bubble.
Yeah.
Also, he came out, he was really little, and he was, you know, like I said, he came out early. So that's scary and all that kind of stuff, but it's great.
It's amazing when there's, because, you know, like different health issues that you have with your kids or scary moments that you have, especially when they're little, how they just, you don't even almost, and they seem so terrifying. And I mean, we had a couple with our kids, and but then when they're past, you're just like, you don't even remember it. You're like, oh yeah, right. There was that moment where we were terrified that the kid was going to die any moment, you know?
Yeah. There are all those. Well, yeah. Certainly. And then, and it keeps going too. I remember we were talking the other day, cause like Archie's had so many stitches, you know, he's not even 12 yet. And he started young. He was like maybe 4, and he, got like 7 stitches in his forehead.
Is he a daredevil, or is he just kind of clumsy?
He's not even clumsy. He's got good coordination. It's just, he kind of flings himself at stuff physically.
Oh yeah.
Like he's just kind of like, he's the kind of kid, he quite literally does this. He runs one direction while he's looking back another direction. and I'm always like, you know, you're really going to hurt yourself if you don't look where you're going. And it's been,
like a basic rule in the human user handbook.
I forget how long ago it was. It was within the last couple of years. He had to go, he ran in the kitchen, he ran into this chair, and he ended up having to get stitches between his toes. It was, and he'd like, it was so gross. Ugh. And this was like the third or fourth time he'd gone for stitches. And this time we went in and the guy said, you know, and I've been there before where I've had to hold him down when he got him in his head and he's like 4. I had to hold him while the guy was giving him stitches, and he's screaming in my, like looking into my eyes going, Daddy, why are you doing this? And I'm like, oh God, it's so painful. Your kids, you know? So by the time he's like 10 and getting the stitches in his foot, then the doctor goes, you can come in, but we can do it. And you know, my nurse can hold. I was like, yeah, that's fine. I'm like, I don't need any more trauma at this point. I've already held him 4 times. He already associates sheer terror with my face.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
and also, Daddy, why are you doing this to me? Cause you keep fucking up, kid. I mean, for Christ's sake, what do you mean? Why are we doing this? Look at your toe.
Cause you're acting like a zero.
Yeah. Cause you're a loser. A loser.
I'm just telling you what my dad told me. You're a loser.
Well, and at least too, it's like he's getting the webbing of his toes stitched, so no one's going to think that you were abusing him.
Right, you know, right.
Like what kind of child abuse is that?
We picked a really good spot that nobody would see.
I will rub a piece of paper between your toes, son.
Oh God. It was so painful too. Poor guy. He actually missed a school trip. It sucked.
I was one of those kids that was, I cut my head open, like pushing back on a high chair and hit a bookcase, broke my leg, broke my thumb, tons of stitches from cuts and shit, I don't know.
I didn't do that stuff until I was like later. Like I broke my kneecap. I got a fracture in my kneecap when I was like 18.
Ooh.
And then, I had knee surgery in my other knee. Like everything happened kind of later for me, which I saved it for adulthood for when it really hurt and I can remember it.
Yeah. When your body can't bounce back as well.
Oh my God. I turned 50, Andy.
Oh, really?
Me. Can you believe it? Me.
It's not fair.
The guy guy.
I've been 50 for 15 years.
I know. I remember on your 40th, when we went away, you, me, and Kent and Giles, and when you turned 40, and when on your 40th, you turned 50. That's how.
I did. It was weird. You got to see it. Yeah, we went away. That's right. On my 40th birthday, we had a boys' weekend of playing golf.
Yeah,
and
eating steak.
And then because golf and steak, and because
I know what you're gonna say.
Two of you are sober.
Yeah,
like you just sat and watched me drink. Order another one, and then watch me like you were old men watching me jerk off for you or something.
I knew you were going to say that. And I remember you were like a couple of drinks in and we were so enthusiastic. We're like, Andy, get more. And you were like, you were kind of mad. You were like, you guys just want to watch me drink.
Well, it did feel like, it had nothing to do with, my panache, like the way that I drank. It was just the drinking. You could have been watching anybody. I felt like that just it took all the romance out of it.
That was fun.
That was a fun weekend.
That was really fun.
Well, now luckily you have dual citizenship, do you not?
I do, yeah.
So you can bug out of here,
I can head back to the homeland I can just scoop up all the kids and just go. Or maybe I'll leave them.
Is that it? What? Yeah, come on. New country. I mean, new old country. New slate. Start over. Yep.
I'm just going to go back, and then I'll go do one of those surgery. I'll change my face.
Right.
And I'll just, and I'll go work at a Tim Hortons back in Canada, and I'll just forget it all.
Right. Well, while you're getting a new face, you should just, become Drake.
Oh, that's a good idea.
You go to Toronto, and you go there as Drake, you'll be set.
I would be, you're right. If I was Drake in Toronto, forget it. How good would that be?
Yeah.
I don't have to worry. I'd buy Tim Hortons if I was Drake.
Yeah. Yeah. I wonder if Drake owns any Tim Hortons.
I met that guy once. He seemed really nice. I was coming out of, I was waiting outside of a hotel in Toronto at 6 a.m. in dead of winter to do some press for something. So they're like, the car service is going to come down. And it was maybe it was even 5:45. So it was still dark and it was snowing heavily. And this SUV pulls up and there's nobody else in front of the hotel because it's early and it was desolate. And I thought, well, that's definitely free. And I went out, it was freezing. And I get out and I'm about to just grab the door and get in. And the door opened and Drake got out. and it was like, oh, sorry. I thought he was like, hey, what's up? And I was like, hey, man. And we started chit-chatting, which was cool. And then the guy said, no. And then I got a text at that moment saying, no, your car's a few minutes late. You can go back up and chill out. And I was like, oh, great. So I walked back in. And then we had an elevator ride. I guess at the time he was living at that hotel. And so we get in the elevator together. And then he was like, we should hang out sometime. And I was like, totally, we should. And then he got out.
Right.
And that was it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But my number is, don't you want to take my number?
I'm sure Drake is listening to this. Drake, reach out.
Drake, definitely reach out. My number is 555-1212. People don't do that joke anymore, Andy.
They don't. And they should.
It's a good one.
Klondike 5. That was the old version.
Murray Hill 34.
Did you ask Drake at all about Degrassi? That's what I would be want to know.
I didn't. I thought that if I opened with that, he'd be like, okay, this clown wants to come in. This guy
has no appreciation for my music.
He wants to bring up Degrassi.
Like, Much like when Jimmy was in Degrassi, no one really cared about his music that much.
Nobody did. But, I mean, yeah, he was in Degrassi. And what's cool, you know, Drake has stayed in Toronto. He is an icon in Toronto. And yeah. he stayed there, and he's built this huge house, and he's just like Toronto. And I get it. Toronto's actually a great place to live. I've spent a lot more time there in the last couple of years. All joking aside, like, have I had moments where I thought like maybe I'd go back? Yeah, I have. I've had a few moments like that, and I like what Drake's done, and I think that I like that he has brought attention to Toronto, and that he's kind of tried to, you know, promote the music scene in Toronto. I think it's kind of cool. Again, this is, I think he and I should be friends.
Right. He also, he brought an NBA title to Toronto. That's really something.
He did bring, yeah. I guess he did.
He sure did.
Right?
Without Drake Aubrey Graham, that would not have happened.
I would love you to get on one of those morning drive sports shows and argue with some of those sports assholes. And you'd be like,
who cares about the, it was Drake's doing. He brought, like a hip hop flair to an otherwise white northern city.
We got Andy Richter on the phone here with Boston Sports. All right. Yeah, you know what? I'm just calling in, Andy. Fuck you, fucking Drake. You know.
Now, I get, you know, there's people that do like a little bit of research for this show. I think it's Wikipedia. I mean, come on. What do you want? Nobody makes any money at this. You got a podcast. You know how it is.
Yeah, of course.
But I saw something that, like, you got kicked out of boarding school, which mm-hmm. Because I know so much about you, but sure. I didn't know that you got kicked out of boarding school.
Did you not know that?
No.
Have we never talked about this?
No. I mean, unless you don't want to talk about it.
No, it's fine. Yeah. Here's the thing. Because I still can. They had a problem with Class A drugs, and for me now, and this is
uncool. Way to go, narcs.
And I don't want to get into a bunch of lawyers. No. First of all, I always contend that I wasn't kicked out, and this is a very sort of fine distinction to make. But I was asked not to come back.
Oh, right.
Okay, so I wasn't kicked out like mid-year. I finished 10th grade, and they said, you know, handshake, like, we're good here, right?
Yeah. Fuck off now.
Yeah. And I was like, yeah, I'm out. And, you know, I went to boarding school when I was 12.
Wow.
Which I now realize, you know, having my own kids, how young that is.
Yeah.
It was a different time. It was a different era. It was different, you know, I don't know, in Canada at that time and whatever. I think that I went to a school that there was very sort of much more of an old school sort of English style boarding school in a lot of ways.
Yeah. How far from home?
A couple hours north of Toronto.
Yeah.
Up in the woods or
where they can't hear you scream.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know, to be honest, at first when I went, I was excited to go. Because not that I necessarily wanted to go get away from home. I was just excited. I was 12. It was like, yeah, I'm going to go to like camp.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
In a way, like they have a lot of sports there and you're kind of outside and it was an outdoor oriented school. Like they didn't have a gymnasium. They had no indoor sports. It was all, you know, it was kind of like what they have here in this kind of Outward Bound.
Oh, really? Kind of
like, cool. Yeah. So like by the time you get to like 9th, 10th grade, like you'd get graded on things like winter camping and running rapids in a canoe and stuff like that. That was your PE grade.
Wow.
Yeah. So you had school and then you had a lot of outdoor shit like that.
Right.
You had to rappelling down. So it was.
Well, it is Canada.
It's Canada.
You got to be rugged.
I dug it, man. Like we went away, like the whole school would go on a thing called Expedition Weekend where the entire school went on a canoe trip. And they would stagger everybody out in groups and stuff. And you'd go on these lakes way out. And it was like, I don't know. That's pretty fucking cool.
That is cool. And now it's all boys or is it co-ed?
It was at the time all boys. It's now co-ed.
Okay.
So initially I was into it. And then, yeah, there came a point where I wasn't as into it. Because, you know, 12 is one thing. Then you're 16 and... You know, on the weekends, like you want, there were no, I mean, we have weekends, but like, there was nothing to do and you were way up there and you couldn't do anything. You weren't allowed to like go out. And
yeah,
we wanted to go out and hang out with girls and do all that kind of stuff. And so I started getting in trouble. I started, you know, smoking butts in the woods and, you know, doing, you know, having a little drinky poo here and there and then getting in trouble.
Yeah.
And my parents, to their credit, realized that I'd sort of outgrown it and that it wasn't great for me, wasn't a great environment. And so I went home. I came back to Toronto.
Yeah.
And
was it weird to come back home? I mean, when you've been away, I mean, I know you're home for the summer, I assume.
Yeah, of course.
But is it, because like I, you know, my first 2 years of college, I went away and then I transferred to a school in Chicago and then like had to go back and live with my mother. And it was like, that was a bummer. You know, like I had been out for 2 years and then came back home and I was like, oh, fuck, you know.
Yeah.
Was it that kind of feeling a little bit?
A little bit. I think it was a little bit. And it had been so Lord of the Flies that I came back and I was like, I'm the boss now, you know.
Oh, boy. And, oh, boy.
No, that's not true. That's
I've seen you like that with a maitre d'. It's not pretty.
Because they never give me the table I demanded. That I deserve, yes. Andy. But yeah, it was weird coming back. It was weird. And I think that, I came back, I guess I was like 16 or whatever. And then by the time I was 20, I moved to New York. So it was really only like 4 years. And I really never thought about it that way actually until this moment, like that adds up. I guess sort of in a lot of ways, mentally, I was already out of the house. And so by the time I left and moved to New York and I was 20, that wasn't really that scary to me.
Yeah. You know? Just to go back a little bit, what was the motivator, I think? Like, did the rest of your siblings, because you got three siblings, you got sisters and a brother?
Two older sisters and a younger brother, yeah.
Had they gone to boarding school too?
No.
What was the motivation with you? Just to get you out of their fucking hair?
First of all, yes, for sure. Because you've known me a long time.
Stop talking.
I'm a handful, Andy. You know that.
A delicious handful.
Sure. And I think
like trail mix.
Yeah. I was I'd been at a school in Toronto called the Toronto French School, which is a very it was a very sort of, as schools should, good schools should be, it was very academic oriented and it was very demanding.
Yeah.
It was a school that was really sort of confectionery oriented.
It was named after French Stewart from Third Rock from the Sun.
Which I didn't know.
The curriculum was all his career.
Which was crazy because the show hadn't even come out yet. So I'd gone to a school that was very much about very stringent and very tough academically. And I think that there was a lot of burnout. Certainly my sisters had burnout too, and they were really good students and it was tough. I mean, I remember in fifth grade, I took, for a semester, I took Russian. They broke down like the sciences.
Fifth grade, wow.
Yeah. They broke down all the sciences into the different, physics and chemistry and biology. In fourth grade, you had exams and you had to study. It was really rough. And I think at that point, my parents realized like that was not going to hold my interest, that I was like, I'm blowing out of this joint. And
yeah,
I'm not.
Yeah.
And so that was part of the reason that I went to a school that was much more kind of well-rounded. And, and my brother was is almost 10 years my junior. And I think that, probably, I guess he was like two when I left. And I'm sure my mom was like, I can't deal with you and a baby, and your older sister. I think there were a lot of things.
Send the baby away. I know.
That's what I kept saying.
He's the stranger.
That's what I kept saying as I was holding him over the railing. We're getting rid of the baby, right? Andy.
Come on. There's an awning below.
Look, it doesn't take, you don't have to go to therapy to realize I was the baby for almost 10 years and then he came along,
How dare he.
So, but anyway, I think my parents were really just trying to find a solution so that I could be okay. And, and God bless him. It was definitely weird. And then I came back and my sisters went to college and I was, And again, I was just like, I wanted to do something else. And I just never wanted to be where I was.
Yeah. Did you go to a regular high school then?
I went to what they call an alternative high school for the first couple of years, and I graduated from regular high school. Okay. So I went to three high schools.
Oh, wow.
But it was kind of okay. I went to this high school for a while that was run by my close friend of the family, my godmother, and she ran this really cool, that was run by the Toronto. It was a public high school, but I could take theater classes and get credit for it. And I had my own kind of curriculum, and there were no actual classes.
Wow.
And I just had to do all the work and have one-on-one. It was very cool. And again, it was, they'd been doing it for a few years by the time I got there, and the Toronto Board of Education, you know, Liberal Canada, way to go, Liberal Canada.
Looking
for new ways for kids to get educated that might be great.
Right.
How dare they?
Thinking of the kids first.
I know. Bunch of jerks. And it was actually, that was a really great environment for me. And I did very well there. And it was awesome.
But you didn't graduate from there.
No, because I couldn't get all the necessary. It was basically because I couldn't get all the credits I needed.
To get to college?
I think I needed to get to graduate. I needed a certain math and stuff that they didn't offer at that school. So I had to go and finish for one semester at this other school.
Did you go to college at all, or did you just head off to New York?
I went briefly. I went for one semester to Concordia University in Montreal.
Yeah.
And then I remember—
Not cold enough in Toronto for you?
I had to get to Montreal where it's real cold.
Oh, my God. It's ridiculous there.
And then I went back. The next time I went back to Montreal was when we were shooting Blades of Glory, and I was wearing a leotard and chasing Will, Ferrell outside and freezing. Anyway, I remember calling my dad and saying, like, I went to college, and I remember thinking at the time I was with a lot of people I'd grown up with. And some are at Concordia, and a lot of them were at McGill, where both my sisters went. And I remember kind of looking around and having this moment, and everybody's just doing what they're doing in college. They're having a good time. They're studying, but they're having a really good time. And Montreal is a great party city.
It's a great town.
It's unreal. And
yeah,
I was having a lot of fun, too much fun. I really wasn't doing much school. And I kind of looked around, and I thought, I did have this moment where I went, I'm just going through the motions. I'm wasting my time here. This is a waste of time. And maybe these people are not wasting their time, not for me to say, but I can't do this. Where am I going to go if I just keep doing this? I don't see any. And I called my dad, and I basically said that. And my dad's been awesome throughout my life. And a lot of times I didn't even realize until later, and I look back, of how great my dad has been. And I think that he could have had gone one of two ways. He could have thought, wow, you're such a fuck up, and stick with it, and no, you got to stay in college and do, do, do. And he really heard me, and he went, okay.
Yeah.
And he said, come on home and get a job. And if you want to go to, and he goes, what do you want to do? And I said, I think I want to go to New York. I really think I want to do this acting thing. And he said, well, then you better come home and make the money so that you can go.
Yeah.
He was like, I'll pay for you to go to college. I'm not going to pay for you to go do that.
Ray, yeah.
I'll help
That's
you.
That's really a credit to your dad too, because he's not like, a mosaic artist. He's a business guy.
Yeah.
Like he's a lawyer, right? A lawyer and a business guy. And, I don't know, maybe it's just my mind of business guy type dads would be like, no, you need to get into business. Because, I mean, even my mom is as supportive as she was, she was in sales, and she's like, you should just, when I was struggling, when I was making no money and trying to do this for a living and not podcasting. Who the fuck knew there was such a thing?
Day you will podcast, Andy?
I don't know what it is, Mom, but I want a podcast. It sounds dirty. It probably is. She was like, you should just get into sales. You'd be so good at sales, which is basically like saying, like, you should just like pour cancer into your soul. Like, that was what it sounded like to me. Like, get into sales. Like, oh, you mean die? Are you saying I should just die?
Get fitted. Fitted for what? Fitted for the Smith & Wesson you're going to put in your mouth.
You but know? Anyway, so kudos to your dad. That's really, yeah. I love it when parents are like, yeah, whatever, do it, you know.
Yeah, I mean, and by the way, and by extension, of course, my mom too, they were very supportive in that way. I mean, it wasn't, obviously there was friction in those times and when they're worried about their kid and is this is potentially the road to ruin for this
we might be facilitating a major fuck up.
Yeah, major fuck up. And but yeah, he really heard me. And you know, I look back, my dad, as you said, my dad is a fairly, he's not conservative, but he was a corporate lawyer for many, many years. And then he went into business for one of his clients and he ran that business. And he just did a lot of sort of those. And he lived and operated in a very serious world that had very, very set boundaries. And you know, you do that, you do X and Y and you'll get to Z. And yeah. I think that, there were times though where he really was able to think outside that and understand. And it wasn't until years later, it was actually a couple of years ago, where I actually was able to kind of say to both my parents, I really appreciate that. I know that my life is unorthodox to you. And I really appreciate that you've been able to roll with me on it.
Yeah.
It's meant a lot to me. And that I'm very happy that I was able to actually say that to them while they're still alive.
Yeah.
Because I do plan on murdering them. I want to announce on the podcast. I'm excited to say.
There could only be one. There could only be one.
No, but truly, my mom has always been very supportive too, I will say, not in any way like, you're going to go and do something and whatever. She wasn't like that.
You're going to be a star.
Yeah, I can't wait. Not at all. Like,
yeah.
You know, there's a lot of like, also like tough love on that too. Like, you know, even when things go great, kind of like, you know, it's hard. She can be stingy with a compliment. Let's put it that
way.
Right,
right.
You know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, and she, you know, they know you too. Like your people know you. So like, even when things are going good, if there's something that's like not quite right, they know that too, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So when you're 20, you go to and also too, kudos to your dad for saying like, you better come home and make some fucking money, you know? Cause again, that's like,
yeah,
you know, to just say like, all right, son, I'll write you a check and you go to New York. Oh boy, that's a dangerous
thing. No, my dad came from very little. Both his parents were teachers in Manitoba. And ew. I know.
Gross. There's
like the least honorable profession, teachers. My dad's dad, my grandfather, Emerson Arnett, he started the Manitoba Teacher Society. So he's a teacher and he started a union, Andy.
Oh my God.
So that teachers could be treated fairly,
right,
and all that kind of stuff.
Well, thank
terrible.
God his son went to the boardroom.
I know. <right? laughs> Well, you know what? What's interesting is my dad was always, my grandfather died when I was quite young, my dad's dad. And, which was a pity because I never got to really know him that well. And by all accounts, he was a really cool, great guy. And my dad felt a lot of guilt about sending me and his kids to private school.
Yeah.
And I think that it kind of went against a lot of, you know, my dad had nothing. My dad met my mom the first time he was, you know, my mom was grew up in Winnipeg, and then they would go to the lakes, to Lake of the Woods. And all these people had, you know, these big cottages, and my mom's family had a big cottage. And my mom met my dad at a party. My dad was a boat boy for a rich family. They used to have this position
boat
of
boy.
Boat boy.
Wow.
Yeah.
And which was mostly a sex thing, I gotta imagine.
No, fully a sex thing.
Oh, okay, and, okay.
Yeah, by then it was just a full-time sex job.
Right, right.
No, he was, you know, he was like the guy who, because they had these elaborate, old, and beautiful, you know, places on these lakes with these boathouses, and they'd have these old mahogany boats, and
constant upkeep,
and then he had to go and get groceries and do all that kind of stuff, and it was like a summer job, you know, and so that's, and my dad was kind of like the poor kid who was working the job as the boat boy.
Yeah,
and then he's this kid, and he goes to university and school in Winnipeg, and then he gets a scholarship to Harvard, and he goes to Harvard based on his smarts, not like a lot of kids who go with I'm trying to bring up Kushner because I'm trying to be current.
I thought you were going for Conan.
Oh, forget Conan.
I know.
I mean, that was just a redhead quota.
Right, exactly.
You know.
Like, So
my dad was a self-made guy in every sense. And I remember when I went to school with all, this boarding school, and there were a lot of really some fancy people who went to that school, including Felipe, who was then the prince, and he's now the king of Spain.
Wow.
Yeah. And I knew him, which is weird, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Have you kept in touch with the king of Spain?
Yeah. 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 I'm the official jester at the Spanish court.
No, but I mean, if you bumped into him at something, would you be like, hey, I went to school with you?
Yeah. 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 Felipe? No, he'd remember. Yeah.
Yeah.
For sure. I actually, a couple of years ago, was going to Madrid for some press thing. I do a lot of press, Andy.
I know. Well, and, you're in all kinds of stuff. I hate you.
I know you do.
Oh, I'm nothing but envy.
Green with envy. I got from a guy who was his roommate a way to get in touch with him. And then I ended up going and I couldn't do it. I was too busy for the king.
sorry, King.
Sorry. I got a photo shoot.
For Lego Batman. I'm Lego Batman, King. Sorry. Like,
wait, it's just your voice. Why would they photograph you? Which, by the way, Ricky Gervais always says to me, like, we joke around, and he's like, I don't know why you'd need to be in shape as a voiceover artist. I was like, fuck you. Yeah. Anyway, so I went to school with a lot of these fancy types, and I remember one time there was some kids were going to go on this trip, and I always had a job like on Christmas break and when I'd come home, and in the summer when a lot of these kids did not because they were super wealthy, and my dad would be like, I remember kids were going on a trip, and I said, can I go? And he said, no. And I said, well, so-and-so are going. He goes, yeah, well, they're going to be losers. You're not. And he basically was saying, like, you got to come home and fucking realize you got to earn it.
Yeah, yeah.
And these kids can go and have a free ride, but that's not going to lead to good things. And I, at the time, remember being, like, so mad about it.
Yeah.
And all these years later, I realized, what an unbelievable gift my dad gave me with that.
Yeah.
He really did. It was such a gift.
Do you think you'll do that with your kids?
No way. Sorry, finish the question. Go ahead, finish the question.
No, because I mean, I'm right there with you. Midwestern, nobody really had any money. I mean, we weren't poor. Nobody ever, obviously nobody went hungry. I always would like, because I was working when I was 12 years old, I had a paper route, and then I was working for my family's family businesses. And I mean, and it was like three different ones. It was plumbing, kitchen. And then my uncle had a office supply, like he built lockers and pallet racks and things like that.
Yeah,
so I mean, my youth was just riding around in a truck or crawling under a house and I always felt with my kids, like they're going to learn to eat shit just like I did. No, I mean, but like, because there is something about having to work that gives you a real idea of what I do think is the reality of the world, which is there is a lot of time when, and I don't want, I certainly don't want my kids to be submissive, but there are times when you just have to do something unpleasant because there's some other thing at the other end of it, like whether it's to make money or, whatever. That's just the way it is. But like my son's 20 and he's never really had a job. Like, we're getting to the point where I think he really should. And he's done lots of kind of volunteer things. Like he for a long time was doing environmental work with the group Tree People here, which is like, they clear trailheads and they plant trees and stuff. And he did a lot of stuff with them, but it was always just like for him to get a job. It always felt like he went to a pretty demanding school. He had a lot of schoolwork, and it just kind of never got there. And it wasn't, and I'm not the kind of dad that's going to be like, you get $40 and then, you know, like,
yeah,
you know, I mean, and they don't live a lavish lifestyle, but it's kind of like,
Well, it's tough. You love your kids and you want them to be happy. So then you're like, well, I want to provide and let them do this and stuff.
Yeah,
and then,
yeah.
But what is the balance of what's good for them and what's not? And I remember, well, two things. I don't know what it's going to be like. This is something I've been thinking about a lot lately about what kind of experience do I want my kids to have? And am I, you know, my kids are really lucky in a lot of ways. And you know, their parents have worked a lot and done relatively well. And so they have a lot of opportunity. And I want to make sure that that opportunity doesn't hurt them in the long run.
Mm-hmm.
I had a good friend of mine who's a producer. And a couple of years ago, his son was in college. And he said, forget what the circumstances, but it was some sort of version of, well, he's doing this. And it was the summer. And he was like, he's doing this. And he's just kind of hanging around and blah, blah, blah. And I said, how old is your son? At the time, he was like 20. I said, you got to make him come back home and get a job. He grew up with a lot of rich kids.
Yeah.
His dad does really well. I said, I'm telling you, if I've learned anything, just do it. If he's having this moment, the best thing you can do is make him earn it right now himself. You're showing him how to live a life. Yeah, you were saying like you give your kid money because, you know, you want to show him that he should earn it, whatever. But what the thing is the experience. You can't buy that kind of experience. And yeah. Jason was saying, Bateman on the show the other day on our podcast that I said, have you ever had a real job, like a real world job? And he said, no. And he said, I really wish I'd had. And I can see that he was kind of, because we've talked about it before and we were talking about shit jobs. I was, you know, I tree planted for a summer. We got 7 cents a tree up in Northern Ontario.
Wow.
And attacked by black flies. And it was just a horrible, crappy job, sleeping in tents. It sucked.
Yeah, yeah.
But that experience, I've always taken that with me. I used to replace water main and sewage pipe with this, and would take out the old pipe and bust it with a sledgehammer in a hole.
Yeah.
And I did that for 5 months. That fucking sucked.
Yep.
But, you know, the experience, incredible.
Yeah. And it makes you appreciate, too, like the times when you might want to get crabby on a movie set because you have to wait or something like that.
Of course.
Yeah, yeah.
That's why I always laugh, too, when you hear – when I love the sort of the refrain of, you know, liberal left coast, west coast, you know, elites or whatever, you know, Hollywood. And I'm like, fuck you, bro. I fucking earned everything. I didn't have any success doing what I'm doing until I was 33.
Yeah.
All I did was fucking work a million jobs. All I fucking did was work hard. And people will say, well, you grew up a rich kid. Fuck off. I fucking earned everything. I wasn't given fucking anything. You can suck it.
There's not. I mean, if you bust it up sewer pipe, that's not like there's not a lot of LA kids doing that.
No fucking way. And there are not a lot of people, period, who would take that. It's a tough job. It sucked.
Yeah.
I was so broke, I had to ride a bike 5 miles to the shop to then get assigned onto one of the crews at the thing. So I'd ride my bike 5 miles. It wasn't like a fucking joyride. I was in Winnipeg, Manitoba, and I'd ride a bike and then get on the truck and go and bust pipe for 12 hours and then come home.
Yeah.
And my arms were so sore that I couldn't fucking lift anything. And all I do is go home and get into bed and fall asleep.
Yeah. Yeah.
And just pray that the nightmare would be over.
Yeah.
Know?
Yeah. Yeah. There is something. And there also, too, is like I find, because I look back on like when I worked for a moving company and I would realize, because I was also trying to start to get into film production at that time. And I'd work for, 10, 11 hours moving, and then I'd get on the bus and be going home and just be a sweaty, filthy mess. But I would feel like, okay, but it's done. Like, I don't, there's like, I don't need to think about that now. Like yeah. that's behind me. And I could sort of, there's still, there are times, not so much now, because now is weirder than any other time in the world. But
sure.
when I'm like longed for like just the simplicity of like the job of a house painter. Like you go, you paint the house and then you go home and you're not a house painter anymore. You don't have to worry about the next day painting the house. It's like no. it'll be there, you know?
I my sort of fantasy moment that takes me away sometimes is I remember I had this like studio apartment on 21st Street in New York that I lived in for years. And all I had was I had a futon, not even a full futon, just the mattress on the floor. On the floor that during the day I would roll up. And because it was studio, so my bedroom was also my living room.
Yeah.
And I'd roll it up. And then I had a tiny TV that somebody gave me. And I didn't have cable. Actually, I stole cable, I think. Shit, that's a federal offense, isn't it?
It's okay. The statute of limitations, because you're really old now. So that was a while ago.
That's a good point.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it was on a board between two milk crates. And, but it was a very simple time in my life. I had no responsibilities. I was a young man. And there are moments, you know, when things, you know, where I look back and I go, I didn't realize how good I had it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Other people listening to, this is the problem with like talking about this kind of stuff, is there's people listening to this who have a TV between two milk crates who are like, fuck you. You know?
But they can say fuck you. But the thing is, I did too.
Yeah, yeah.
So, like, you know, that's not some disingenuous, like, it's not some romantic notion.
I know.
Because I saw it in a picture.
Right.
I fucking had it, and I ate cereal three meals a day. So they can go fuck themselves.
Wow.
Yeah.
You Andy, hate poor people.
No, I hate your listeners because they're so mean.
Can't you tell my love's a growing? Well, now, but you do. You go off to New York City, 20 years old.
Yeah.
What was that like? Was it party time? Did you have any connections to anybody? Did you go there completely alone?
Completely alone.
With a cardboard suitcase, got off the bus, immediately got into sex work?
I didn't. I got into sex work a little bit before, it kind of pre-lapped, a little bit before I got there. On the bus on the way there. I always love this story about Steve Martin inducting. Lorne Michaels was getting some award, and Steve says, Lorne Michaels moved to New York from Canada with nothing but the shirt on his back and a cool $1 million. That always made me laugh. It's so funny. I didn't know. I didn't know a soul. I moved to New York. I was 20. It was the summer of 1990, and
going to acting classes. Right, that was
To go to acting at Lee Strasberg in New York, and you know, I got to know people, and you know, through that, you know, those people made some great friends back in those days, and. And then, that's how it started. I just started doing that. I didn't have much of a plan. I probably should have had more of a plan. I didn't other than just go and do this and just kind of take it step by step. And I did that, and it took a number of years. And it wasn't until about a few years later, through this kind of way off Broadway show that we did, I went to meet an agent. And an agent came to see it and said, come in and talk to us. And I went to meet them at the old William Morris. And this agent said, you should go and talk to our voiceover department. And I was like, what's that? And they said, you know, like the voices you hear on commercials and stuff like that. And I was like, oh, yeah, I guess I never really thought that. Yeah, right. There are voices on, because I was so dumb. You know how dumb I am.
I do. Oh, I do.
Yeah. And
right.
And so I started, you know, I booked a couple of commercials and I booked a couple of voiceover things first. But I didn't get my first professional like acting gig until 1995. As an actual actor.
So how long were you in New York before that happened?
Five years.
Wow.
5 years. And I auditioned a bunch. And then I started, I did a couple indie films. And then I started auditioning for, I remember they were like, "Will you do some sitcom, audition for some sitcoms?" I was like, "No, I'm a serious actor." Of course, I needed the money. I needed a job. And I was like, "Yeah, but yes, I'll read for a sitcom." And then I read for a bunch of pilots. It wasn't until 96 that I booked a pilot with Kevin Pollak. He was the star of this pilot for Warner Brothers for CBS and, whom I'm still friends with.
Did that entail LA trips? Like was so pilot I, so season that, go to LA?
Kind I of was doing it in New York and then flew out to LA to do this pilot.
Yeah.
Flew out to LA to test for it. Back in the day, they'd fly you out here to test for the pilot. So I flew out, tested, got it, stayed, did the pilot, thought like everything's changing. Then went back to New York and then nothing changed.
Yeah.
You know, the show didn't happen, whatever, but I started testing more frequently for shows and I started spending, you know, like that. I remember that next year I tested for like five pilots. Then the next year I tested for like eight pilots and every year I was testing for a lot. I was getting closer and closer for stuff. And then I continued to do a couple like indie films in there. And then it was 99. I did a pilot with Mike O'Malley, our friend. And, he had a big, pilot deal at, NBC.
And that one went too, didn't it?
And that one ended up going and we did seven episodes. The only two of them aired and we got canceled.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it was one of those like, this is going to happen. Finally, everything's solved and boom.
Yeah. No. Yeah.
And it was just a lot of that, until
it's such a weird thing too, because you are being successful, like in terms of like what you set out to do, you are being wildly successful just in getting to do that. But it's still just like shoving your dick in the dirt, you know, like just like,
totally.
All right, here we go.
It's, of course you're right. You're being and that didn't escape me. I didn't feel like a failure. Like I knew what the numbers were. I'd gone to school with a million people. I knew tons of actors who weren't getting work or getting even the opportunity. So the fact that I was getting the opportunity was a big deal. I understood that. But it did feel at a certain point after years, it was like, in what shape is the disappointment going to come in this time?
Yeah. It's also too, it's not that like you're being a baby about it. The business makes you feel shitty. The business makes you feel bad about it. They come in, you start out in something. They're like, "We love you. We love you." And then it's like, you know what? We don't love you. And sorry, but you know, it's not good. And that's the feeling you get from these people. It's not like, well, you know, it's this mysterious concoction and who knows and sorry, but we still love you. It's just like, we love you. Oh no, you know what? Fuck you. Get out.
It's hard not to take it personally.
Yeah.
It's very hard not to take it personally. And yet I understand too that ultimately would be my demise if you do take it personally, that you've got to find a way to redirect that. And that's always been, I feel lucky that I've been able to do that. I will say, I don't know why. Maybe again, it's just sort of this naivete or something that I have, but I've had a lot of disappointments, certainly professionally in my life, and that's okay.
Yeah,
I don't. As I've gotten older too, I've gotten a better job of. I've talked about this a lot. I don't sort of gauge how I am as or where I'm at as a person emotionally or mentally or whatever is not indexed to my profession and how I'm doing professionally. It's just not. And because I know it's not a recipe for success emotionally.
Yeah.
So I had a lot of disappointment. It wasn't until Arrested Development that I actually like got the, but even I will say, I talked about this with somebody, maybe I talked about Dax, but I the day I got arrested, the day that Arrested Development happened, and I actually got it coming out of great failure because I'd been fired from a show the year before, which felt really crushing.
Is this 2000, 2001?
This is early 2003.
Oh, 2003. Okay.
Yeah. I had done a pilot the year before. I'd done a pilot the year before and the year before. I'd done one almost every year, and I did one with Sherry O'Terry that got that did not get picked up, and then I did one with at CBS called Still Standing, and that did get picked up, and then I was fired, or my character was written out, but in effect, I was fired.
Yeah,
and it was a real bummer. And I then a year later, had that not happened, I wouldn't have been available for Arrested Development, which changed everything. And but the day I found out that it was going and that it was going to series and that I was on the show, it was like years, it felt different, and years of frustration kind of melted through. And I actually wept after.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
That's sweet.
Yeah, I really did. I actually like cried really hard.
Wow.
Because it was frustrating, and it was hard kind of keeping your chin up. And I'm sure that a lot of people will listen and be like, oh, shut up. You fucking love people who are like actors. And I'm like, you know what, man? It's not easy.
Yeah.
It's not easy. You take a lot of water in this thing.
It's always weird to me. Like one thing and I still haven't figured it out is that really, truly people doing this for a living. And I mean all different walks of performer type, because there are lots of different types of performers.
Sure. Yeah. 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 I'm with you.
They're like almost everybody has issues with rejection. Almost everybody like cannot take it, like has it like a higher sort of like it hurts more. So we go into this fucking business that's a rejection party. It's crazy to me, you know? Yeah. And then the part that even goes further is and then there's award shows where the people who have actually really done very, very well and overcome that rejection parade set themselves up for more rejection.
100%.
Where there's like, oh, there are, you know, there's eight people, but only one gets to feel good and the rest of you get to feel bad because you lost, you know?
100%. And I don't put any stock anymore in those, especially those award things, you know?
They're just weird.
The Emmys, and I'm sure there'll be like Emmy voters like, well, I'll definitely never vote for you now.
Okay,
but
fine.
I'm like, okay, I've been nominated this year. I don't know what's happening with BoJack yet, but like I've been nominated between actor and producing BoJack 7 times.
Yeah.
Never fucking won. And I'm like, so what? Who fucking cares? And people are like, yeah, that's easy to say. I mean it. And they asked me to do, this is probably controversial, not really controversial in the grand scope of things. But, you know, BoJack was nominated and they wanted me, and I've just never won, and they asked us to do like a thing for the voters and stuff. And I just said, nah, I'm not into it. No, thanks. Wow, you should do it. Netflix would like you to do this. And I was like, nah, I'm kind of done with that. I don't give a shit.
Yeah.
Fucking forget it. Why? To go and do a thing for this panel for the thing? Fuck that. Who fucking cares? Who fucking cares?
And the people that will tell you, because I've had friends that have kind of been in Oscar running kind of stuff. And that's the really, like,
people. That's crazy.
Yeah, people don't know. But, like, if you're in a movie, you get cast in a really good movie and it's a really good part and you do really well and people start to say you might win an Oscar. That means for, I don't know, 6 months? You have to go to a constant stream of parties and shaking hands and kissing ass and just dinners with strangers. Just as, it's this campaign. You're running for office to maybe get an Oscar, which what it does for you, it makes you feel good. And I'm sure, I'm speaking, hypothetically, it makes you feel good. It puts your rate up. You can make more money. But ultimately what it does is it brings cachet to the people who own the thing.
Sure. Also, like, nobody's going to remember. You don't remember who won last year, do you?
No.
Who cares? It's got, I guess, for the person. But again, like, maybe the person, especially with an Oscar on a different level, maybe there is that thing like a 2-time Oscar winner, blah, blah, blah. That feels good. But what does it really bring you? And when you got to go do, I remember hearing about a guy who's a still a very active director, writer, and he won a couple of years ago, and somebody said he's the best campaigner, this dude. They said that he started in like October. He goes to all these dinners. He goes tirelessly. He goes to screenings every night, and he talks about it, and he ended up winning. And people were like, in this town, were saying, yeah, he won. It was good, but he worked it till the end. And I'm like, well, then he didn't win by the merits of...
Right. Like, did he win an acting award or a campaigning award?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And like, how can... I guess he can feel better about it, but he knows that he won because he did all that shit. Would it have won without it? Like, there should be no campaigning allowed.
Yeah.
It should be just... And the other thing is, you know, people say... I've never been a part of a film like that, and so I don't know what that process is like, but you start in October, and they're not getting paid to do that either.
Yeah.
You know, so that's just, they can't work. They're just doing that.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't feel bad for you, by the way.
I'm just too curmudgeonly for it. And and it's like you were going to say, like, who's ultimately, what's it going to matter in the long run? Like, like at the end of your life, is it going to... I don't think I ever told you this, but like when this happened, I had elderly relatives and that were in assisted living, and I needed to find a new assisted living place. And so I was looking at all these different, going and touring them. And there was this one kind of far flung out, you know, in LA, like not close and sad. Like basically it was like one of the cheaper ones, and you get what you pay for, because it was just like old people sitting staring into space. Ugh. And it was a bummer. But the lady, the super chipper lady, because they all kind of have, you know, like salespeople that are like, you're going to love it. And then it's like, oh, no, I'm not. It smells like pee and everyone seems sad. But she stopped. We were walking down a hallway, and there was a woman sitting, again, just an elderly woman staring into space. And she stopped in front of her like she was a museum display, pointed at her and said, 3-time daytime Emmy winner. And then we walked on. I was just like, oh my God, if you were trying to bum me out, lady, you could not have done a better job.
Oh my God.
Three-time Emmy winner.
Oh my God.
Oh.
That's one of the worst things I've ever heard.
Oh, it was really like, it was like one of those things that was so awful, it was exciting. You know what I mean? Like I was like kind of jazzed by it. Like, oh my God, that's such a bummer. That's such a bummer. Like, wow.
I know.
Thank you, life.
It's, I mean,
yeah,
it's such an embarrassing. Well, again, it is, to get back to our original thing, it's such a ultimately constantly demeaning business to be on so many levels. And I don't know. There are days where you're just like, oh God, it's such a bummer.
Yeah. What did you set out to do? Did you have like a thing in mind or, you know, were you kind of just catch as catch can and see where this goes?
Yeah. You know, I think that I used to joke that I wanted to be a serious actor. I wanted people to take me seriously when I was young. And then I kind of fell into doing comedy by mistake, or that people laughed at my serious acting. But I didn't really have a plan. I mean, I one of my regrets is that I never got into sketch comedy early.
Yeah.
And then I never did it. And because I think I would have really liked it. And
you would have been really good. I mean, you are good at it. You know, because it's Arrested is like, yes, it's a sitcom, but it's also sketches.
Yeah, of course it's sketches. Yeah. Yeah. And so like all you guys who are from Chicago or went to Chicago, you know, especially when Amy and I started dating and sort of meeting all you guys, like I was like, oh, there was this whole world. I would have loved to have been part of that.
Yeah.
To just fuck around. You know me. I just want to fuck around all the time.
It was the best. It was just, you know, like that, those days of youth of just being around, like you spend your whole life doing whatever and thinking, ah, maybe I can do this. And then all of a sudden you're just around all these fucking weirdos that are just like you, that just want to fuck around and have fun.
When I see pictures of like, when I see pictures of you guys and you and like Stack and like all, and McKay and all those guys, all you guys back in Chicago back in the day, and Besser and Ian and Walsh and whatever. And I always like, I'm like, oh, that was like the boat I missed, like the party I missed. And I loved, I never tire of you telling me like stories of IO and like the water leaking and Sharna freaking out or whatever the fuck it is. Like weird. I'm always like, that's the thing I wish I had done. That's my, honestly, it's my only kind of regret.
Yeah. Do you think, and when you and Amy started dating, was that, and well, you obviously said that was kind of when it opened up your mind to that. Did it also open up you up to the notion of being a comedian more? Or
would- I was already starting to do, well, I was already starting to do sitcom pilots and stuff. So I was kind of in that, moving in that direction as well as simultaneously. You know, Amy and I started dating about 7-8 months before she started on SNL.
Mm-hmm.
I had kind of moved briefly to LA to get out of New York, and then she came into LA and we started dating when I was living in LA, and then she was basically kind of living in LA, and then all of a sudden she was like, I think I'm gonna do SNL, and I said, okay, let's go. And we got rid of the apartment in LA and moved back to New York.
Mm-hmm.
And it was in that time that I started doing more. But at the same time, it opened my eyes to it, certainly. But then I started doing a play in New York. At one point, I was doing this play in New York right before I got Arrested Development. And then Arrested came out of the blue. But that it all kind of happened at the same time. The first couple of years that Amy was on SNL, there was a moment where I thought I'm just going to keep doing my voiceover stuff and maybe I'll just never make it as an actor, and that's okay.
Yeah.
And I was kind of at weird peace with it. Doing this play, and I just thought, oh fuck, I hated it. And
the writer drama?
It was a drama, and she hated me, the writer of this play, and it was just like an awful situation.
Whenever I've done anything that's been I've done very little just like straight up drama, and it's always like, I'm always amazed, like no one wants to have any fun. Like, you know, like it's the difference of that whenever I've done something like that, I'm like, wow, when do we start like goofing around? You know, like when do we start like during the run throughs where we're not filming anything, like where we start fucking around with the lines and teasing each other and doing funny accents, like, never? Really? You people do this all day? You just act all serious about this? And you believe, you know, and it's always been like TV shit. So it's always like the dumbest, you know, like.
Well, you know what's weird about that? First of all, I mean, right. You and I have been on enough of those sets and sets like that together with enough funny people where it's like everybody wants to fuck around, you know?
Yeah.
As you know, on Arrested with Mitch, like Mitch wants to fuck around too.
Absolutely.
It's like, yeah, I guess we got to do this scene and then let's meet back at Video Village so we can do bits on each
other. Right. I know. Like, it almost sometimes the work gets in the way of like what you really are doing there, which is fucking around, you know?
Totally.
Totally.
Totally. Yeah. Totally. And then, so there's this thing I'm thinking about doing this actually serious movie in the next couple months. And it's weird that we're talking about this because I guess last night, as I was kind of drifting off to sleep, I was thinking about what is my approach going to be on set? Because I think I am going to do this thing. And I thought, this is quite serious. And like, because on set, as you know, and just in life, but we're the same. We both fuck around a lot.
Yeah.
And this thing is quite serious. I'm going to have to concentrate quite hard. And what is who's my set persona?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
And you got to feel it out too, because you want to be respectful of other people's processes. Yeah. You know? And so, you know, so there are going to be some people that probably don't. Well, I mean, there's a lot of actors that don't have great senses of humor. Like, you know, I mean, there's a lot of actors with no sense of humor, especially about themselves. So, boy, that would be interesting to see going into that situation, how much you can really fuck around.
Yeah. Yeah, it's going to be a tough one. It's going to be. Right.
Well, tell Scorsese I said hi.
Oh, I will.
Yeah.
By the way, it's just M Dog. That's what he liked. By the way, that's what he likes.
I was drinking coffee. I almost made a spit take there. Yeah, cradle him like a baby. He's a little fella. Well, now, do you have, are there unfulfilled ambitions? Are there things that, like, you wish you were doing that you know, one of these days? I mean, you're doing this dramatic movie. That sounds like that's kind of something that's been.
Yeah, I've been doing that. I'm going to do that. I'm going to do, you know.
I mean, that's been a desire, I guess, is what, you know.
Yeah, but it's not one of those, like, I can't wait to show the world. I have zero.
That's a young person's thing anyway.
Yeah, yeah, it's gone. And my sort of, I really just think about, like, how can I be just happy today? I just want to spend time with the kids as much as I can. And and screw around. And I'm doing the podcast now with Jason and Sean, which has been fun. And
I bet that's fun. I do envy you guys getting to be there with each other. That's nice, you know?
Yeah. Exactly. It's just fun. And if it wasn't fun, we wouldn't do it.
Yeah.
And so we're doing that. And then
whose idea was that?
Mine.
Yours, yeah.
Well, I had an idea. I was going to do a podcast. I was thinking about it after I did Conesies. Yeah. And I'd been thinking about it a little bit before, and then I did Conesies, and then I was like, and then Sean, I told Bateman, and then Bateman told Sean, and then Sean called me and said, I know you want to do a podcast. Let's all do one together. And I was like, well, wait a second. I was going to do one. And they're like, I know, but we're going to do it together. And I was like, okay. And I'm such a pushover.
You got bullied into it.
I know. I really did.
Yeah. By the biggest bullies in show business, Sean Hayes and Jason Bateman.
We got together the week before kind of everything stopped in the world and talked about it. And then the world stopped and we're like, you know what? I guess we should do it now because we're all just at home.
Yeah.
And that's how we started. And so I've been doing that. And then I've just been, you know, I've been writing a lot more. Mark Chappell, my partner and I, we've written a couple movies. We sold a couple. And so we've been doing that. And that's been fulfilling in different ways.
Yeah.
It's been great. I don't know. I kind of feel like I'm doing what I want to do. And, you know, last year I did this Lego show, which was really popular with kids. And I'm really happy.
It was fun. It's a fun show.
Fun show. A lot of families watched it together during quarantine, which was nice to hear. I had a lot of fun doing it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we'll do more of those and I don't know. I wish I had a better plan. I should have had a plan all these years.
I honestly don't think that that's the way to go. I think that I've said this before, I think it's the focus just on kind of a process, you know, like to your process that you take to different situations and then remain open to things. I mean, there are some people that it works where they cannot, like, there are people that I've known in my life where they're like, I gotta write this screenplay and then I gotta direct this thing and I gotta, you know.
Yeah.
And I would look at them and I would think like, oh, I wish I had a little of that. But then I just realized, no, I'm just a different type. I'm kind of like, I like to collaborate. I don't like to be alone that much. I have a drive to want to be acknowledged as, you know, my own entity, separate from that motherfucker, Conan. But
that was the most real you've been this whole time.
No. I mean, but I there know, are I times know. Like I, you know, but I've been like the star of a sitcom and it wasn't that great. Like it wasn't for me. I like being part of the group, you know, and that's more fun because I care more about the doing of the thing than the having the thing or the thing being out there.
I'm with you. I care way more about the doing too. Is it a good experience? Is it fun? And I'm the same way. I like to spend time with people I love and who make me laugh. And I was talking to my buddy this morning and he was saying, what a great gift to be able to look at the world that every day you're trying to, I was saying something about, we were talking about like looking for the, what the bit is or what the funny, he goes, you're so lucky that you spend so much of your time every day looking for the laugh.
Yeah.
And it's a great perspective of life, and you do too. And it keeps you going. I mean, what's the alternative? The alternative is a fucking bummer, man.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'd always rather laugh. And people say to me all the time, this other buddy always goes like, jokingly, he'll say, you know, grow up. And I go, why?
Yeah, yeah.
Why would
What are you talking? What does that even mean?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I do bits that most 50-year-old dudes don't do that would be embarrassing for like what a 50-year-old should do.
Yeah, yeah.
I act like a fucking punk teenager a lot of the time.
Yeah.
And I'm okay with it.
Yeah, yeah. Although your skateboarding skills have really, really terrible.
Fucking, well, yeah, I basically cannot skateboard.
Yeah. You've broken your hip like six times.
It's not great. It's not a great look, but I dress real young.
Oh, too young, if you ask me.
People look at me and they go, that guy's young.
Oh, no, wait.
Oh, wait, wait a second. Wait, we got closer. Wait. We got within 20 feet. Oh, Jesus, he's old.
It must be an undercover cop or something. Well, I mean, we kind of got to like sort of, you know, to have fun is sort of the what have you learned part of this this podcast.
Yeah.
And it's
you don't gimmick. Have to follow. You don't need to follow the rules, right?
No, do not you? Really. Although when I started out, the people that were like the executives who were like 15 years younger than me were, you know, like had notes for the show, which I mean, basically it's like, look, I'm going to talk to fucking people about their lives. That's it. Like, that's kind of it.
Yeah.
But there was a couple notes early on after I did the first one. So we're like, you haven't really explicitly answered the three questions or, you know, like gotten to the three questions, and maybe you should split it up into like 20-minute chunks. And I just was like, yeah, yeah, that's a good note. Fuck that. And then just, I didn't ever do it. But
what,
I mean,
what kind of a soul crushing existence was there? Some, the notes process sometimes crazy.
It's
crazy to me. Yeah.
People got, it's their job to tell somebody something like that's, and that's what, and I can't imagine what it's like to be into something where, you know, you hire somebody like you, and then like have to tell you how to be you and do you, you know?
Yeah. It's, yeah, it's mind blowing to me. Mind blowing.
Yeah. Well, but anyway, what have you learned? Come on, I got to answer these people.
Okay, well, sorry. The thing I've learned, I've just learned, I think, to not take myself too seriously.
Yeah.
To not take all of it too seriously. And of course you do, there are things, you know, that you have to, you want to do a good job. You want things to be good. If you're working on something, you want it to be good. But, and you want to be professional, whatever the fuck that means. But you got to have a sense of humor about yourself, no matter what it is. And I don't know. I guess I've kind of coming back to what we were talking about before. I guess because my dad, my parents, but specifically my dad, it made me kind of go through my paces enough as a kid and as a teenager and a young man that I got a kind of a good sense of who I am as a person. And I'm not defined by what I do. And I don't think I'm a lot different than I was when I first started doing this stuff. I'm not that much different of a person as I was when I was 20.
Yeah. I don't think, I mean, I didn't know you when you were 20, but I would say that if anything, you're just like kind of calmer.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you're just, yeah, you're like more patient and kind of just more centered and not as much of an asshole, you know.
Yes, basically. That's it. No, you can name it for sure. For sure.
I was kidding, but
I know you were.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's it. I think I've learned to just, you know, take it all in stride, and that nothing is forever either. That's the other thing. we attach so much importance to things as they happen and in the moment. And I think that I used to be like, oh shit, this is the way it's going to be. By the way, good or bad.
Yeah.
It's always going to be like this, or it's always going to be shitty like this. And that life just kind of, as it keeps moving, things change and it's nothing's forever.
Yeah.
So stay flexible.
Yeah.
You know,
stay gold, pony boy.
Yeah. That too.
Whatever. I don't know. I'm just trying to seem young by quoting 80-year-old books. Well, I love you, and this is really exciting to get to talk to you, and I hope, you know, maybe we should do a socially distanced hang sometime.
Let's 100%.
Yeah. I got to see that baby.
I know.
I'll touch it with a 6-foot-long stick, like a, you know, like a broom handle.
I'm going to send over some plaster of Paris and we'll get a mold of your hand and then so we can put it on the end of the stick. You know what I mean?
Right. I there are molds of my hand, but they're fist shaped. They're available on the internet. They're in silicone. So I can just get you one of those.
Roxanne, you don't have to paint your nails tonight. Whatever the lyrics are.
Whatever. All right. Well, Will Arnett, thank you for doing this. And your podcast is called
Smartless, as in less smart. Yeah, smartless.
Right, less smart. Because I would have gone with like the three dipshits.
It was taken.
Yeah, that's Barbara. That's Barbara Boxer's podcast.
Thanks for having me, man. Sure. I love you, Andy. I miss you too.
I miss you very much, and thank you all for listening to this episode of The Three Questions. And there will be another one next week. There's nothing anyone can do about it. I've got a big, big
love for you. The Three Questions with Andy Richter is a Team Coco and Earwolf production. It's produced by me, Kevin Bartelt, executive produced by Adam Sachs and Jeff Ross at Team Coco, and Chris Bannon and Colin Anderson at Earwolf. Our supervising producer is Aaron Blair, associate produced by Jen Samples and Galit Sahayak, and engineered by Will Beckton. And if you haven't already, make sure to rate and review The Three Questions with Andy Richter on Apple Podcasts.
This has been a Team Coco production in association with Earwolf.